Georgia's DBHDD is urging people to store and lock away all medications to prevent theft and keep them away from children and pets. Old medications can be disposed at Dropbox locations. Dropbox locations can be found at opioidresponse.info.
Glad to have you all with us for another edition of Political Rewind. It's Wednesday, February 24th. By the way, I was reminded in a message that I got from someone this morning who asked not to be named that today would have been Zell Miller's 89th birthday, the former governor and United States Senator of Georgia, who had as much impact on the direction of Georgia during his tenure, particularly in two terms as governor, as any political leader in the lifetimes of most people in the state of Georgia today. So Zell Miller, who passed away a number of years ago, would have turned 89 today. We have a lot to talk about on the show today. Excuse me. State legislature is now just, I think, overwhelmed with bills that would change how Georgians vote is not an unfair way of describing what's going on. The state Senate yesterday passed a measure that many people consider to be really the most moderate of a lot of what's being proposed. It would require some form of ID, photo ID, or driver's license or whatever for people to vote absentee. But there are much more draconian measures still to come. We're going to talk a bit about all of that today. David Perdue yesterday announced that despite the fact that just a week or so ago, people associated with him filed the legal paperwork that would have paved the way for him to enter the race against Raphael Warnock in 2022, he will take a pass on that race. Remember that Warnock is filling the last 2 years of the seat that had been occupied by Johnny Isaacson, which is why he runs for a full term of 6 years next year. And as I introduce our panel of all journalists from across the state of Georgia today, I do want to make note that Greg Bluestein, AJC political reporter who is with us on Wednesdays, said from the very start that there was no way David Perdue was getting into this U.S. Senate race. You are so smart, Bluestein.
Yeah, well, it just didn't seem like it fit. He didn't seem to relish the campaign trail last year. That's probably an understatement. He has a lot going for him in retirement, to say the least. And it's going to be a really brutal battle. And the people around him seemed very caught off guard by any talk of him running. There are some people who said that he was, you know, he was leaning towards it, but others who knew him really well were saying kind of don't buy it. And I think the biggest surprise, though, is that it took him such a short time to formally announce he's not going to run. Right. I thought he should drag out for a couple more weeks.
Yeah, and I must say that a week ago on the show, you told us that you didn't imagine he was going to make the race. So I just give credit where credit is due. We'll talk more about what Perdue's decision not to run means as Republicans start looking at the 2022 contest with Greg and our other panelists. We're also joined, I'm very happy to say, by a host of GPB TV's Lawmakers, which you can see at 7 o'clock on the statewide GPB television network every night when the legislature is in session. Donna Lowry. Donna, how are you holding up in the middle of this? You've passed the halfway point of this week, right? You passed day 20?
Yeah, we're past day 20. We're on the end of this, going down the hill. But in terms of what's going on there, it feels like it's ramping up because it's been kind of slow until these last few weeks. And now these bills are coming fast and furious and probably crossover day next week. So, yeah, there's a lot going on. So there's a lot of energy, and I love that.
You just mentioned crossover day, and I think it'd be great if you clarify something that came up in our show the other day. Typically, it used to be, traditionally, the crossover day was an established day on the calendar. But they're now more flexible about crossover day. Is that correct?
Yeah, they're flexible and to a certain degree. Like it used to be like between the 25th and the 28th day. The Senate said early on in this session that it would be the 27th day. I talked to a lawmaker who was on the show last night who seems pretty determined. he seems to believe that it definitely will be the 27th. Where that 27th day will fall next week is still up in the air. It could be, you know, because we're going to have 26th day on Monday. But they could take a couple days off. So the crossover could be somewhere within the week, which makes it tough for us to know in terms of a show, but keeps us on our toes.
So just to make it clear, there is some inside baseball about crossover day. But on the other hand, the reason it matters for our listeners is that is presumably the final day that a bill can be passed in one body and then still be considered for passage in the same session by the other body, although we know there are tricks that allow that to be overcome as well. We're also joined today by Adam Van Brimmer. He, of course, is the editorial page editor of the Savannah Morning News. Adam, how are things down in Savannah?
Today is a watershed day, Bill. For the first time since March the 12th, 2020, I dropped two kids off at school this morning.
Wow.
The house is quiet. It's just me, and we have who I think is very confused by the fact that he doesn't have two teenagers to entertain him throughout the day, and it's a very good feeling.
Well, you already anticipated my question. Any anxiety around this?
No. I think they were both excited to go back to school, and I'm excited too. We just got to make sure that my wife or I remember to pick them up this afternoon.
Well, congratulations. That gives me an opportunity to say that tomorrow we're going to be talking with Maureen Downey, the AJC education writer, and a couple of other experts on Georgia schools who are going to talk about where we stand in getting kids back to school, some of the apprehensions parents have, some of the issues that are still being confronted. We'll do that in tomorrow's show. We're also joined today by the president and CEO of Mundo Hispanico Digital, Renee Alegria. Renee, it's great to have you back with us today. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Thank you very much for having me, as always. You know, as we were kind of chatting before the show started, the sun's out, spring seems to be approaching, people are optimistic, it's the new year. What are you going to do, right?
I love the positive note you're bringing to the show today. Greg Bluestein, so the state Senate yesterday passed the bill that would require some form of photo ID or a driver's license number or whatever. And as I said in setting up the conversation, in many ways, the measures passed in the Senate yesterday are the more moderate measures that people on both sides, I think Democrats have been fighting all these election changes, but this has got the support of Jeff Duncan, who opposes some of the more stringent changes. So talk to us a little about what passed yesterday.
Yeah, and you're right. Comparatively, these are some of the more moderate of the, there's now 70 bills by my colleague Mark Nisi's count. So a tremendous number of elections bills pending in the legislature. And this was the package promoted by Jeff Duncan. It was overall the four bills. Most of them were more bipartisan. This voter ID bill, this photo ID bill, was largely passed along party lines. I think there was one Democrat who crossed over to support it. You're right. It has strong support among Republican majority in both legislative chambers. And the AJC poll showed that a majority of Georgia voters support some form of photo ID when it comes to casting absentee ballots. Democrats, though, say it would create a burden for Georgia voters who lack a driver's license or access to some sort of copy machine needed to submit a photo ID if the restrictions, if the legislation ends up requiring that.
Donna, I got an email from one of our regular listeners who is a bit confused by some of the language in an article she read about this morning, which quoted one of the legislators who was working on this bill as saying, well, most people in the state have already got their photo ID submitted in some way or another. There's no place where these records are stored. People are going to have to either photocopy a driver's license and send it. What it really means is that only 3% of people, this according to the senator who made this statement, don't have some form of ID they can submit. Isn't that what it's really about?
That's right. And that's the big concern right now is that you know, so most people do have some kind of ID. So that's not the problem. The big thing is making sure that everyone who does have a photo ID is able to have access to a copier or some kind of way of making sure that their ID is sent in with those ballots. So that's the major thing here. But there are a lot of people who are okay with this one. I mean, I think if things stopped with just this one, everyone would be okay. As Greg mentioned, there's a lot of support, a lot of people who are in support of some kind of ID, but there's a lot more to come. And, you know, the bill that came out late yesterday, the 1-241 from State Senator Mike Dugan, 25 pages long, very extensive. I mean, this was after a day of the Senate debating four major bills. He comes up with his. So, and then to hear Greg say there are 70 out there, there's a lot that's going to be taking place in the next few weeks.
Yeah, I mean, the House has a 48-page bill with changes to election laws that they're looking at as well. Renee, how does a photo ID law, assuming this passes and is signed by the governor, how does this make an impact on people in the Hispanic community in Georgia, many of whom I assume are not driving to? I mean, you've got different kinds of Hispanic voters. It's not a monolithic group. Let's be clear about that. But I assume that there's a disproportionate number of people who may not have driver's licenses or even photo IDs of some sort.
Listen, it doesn't seem like a lot, but it really is. You know, not voting on Sunday, inclusion of an ID, making a photocopy. I mean, these are the little hurdles that when you put them in front of voters, it just makes it a pain in the butt to get around to vote. And any hurdle hinders voter participation. So for the Hispanic community, I mean, these are just examples of a system that is attempting to implement voter suppression and disenfranchisement out there. And you know, like everyone has already discussed, the 70 bills out there, where does it stop? Where is it going to stop? It's a slippery slope, you know? You pass one small bill about having to photocopy your ID, and what's next? So, you know, I mean, the Hispanic community, I don't think is focusedly affected by this, in so much so as everyone takes a look at this and thinks, okay, now what?
Adam, weigh in.
Yeah, in talking to our delegate members down here, they've been all the way going back to the biennial when this first really came up. They've been in favor of the driver's license ID number. I think at least on the House side, that's where they've all been. And let's remember that we all have to put that state ID number on the absentee ballot request form. So it's not, to me, it's not any kind of really hardship to have to scribble that on when you sign to mail the ballot in. I think that's a more of a common sense solution. And I think that that's really where a good portion of at least the folks I've talked to, the Republicans I've talked to in the legislature, that's where they'd rather land. But as we know, that back in December, there was a fringe of people who really were, quite frankly, maybe wanted to overturn the election results. And once that failed, they were looking for whatever the next step was. And for them, it was to really tighten these voting laws and absentee ballots. And I think the best case scenario for everybody is if this bill gets through, that basically says the only change we're going to do to absentee ballots is to put your ID number on the ballot when you send it in. If that's where we land, I think most Georgians will be, a sigh of relief, to say the least.
Greg, the headline on the AJC's Jolt, which you are contributed to every morning, by the way, people can get it at AJC.com, is Why Georgia Elections May Never Be the Same. And because you are a contributor to it, I assume that you're well aware of why that headline, what that headline actually means. So with that in mind, let's start a conversation about some of these other measures and bring everybody else in as well. Donna mentioned Mike Dugan's Senate Bill 241. Here are just some of the things that that bill would do. It would repeal no-excuse absentee voting for most Georgians. It would require a witness signature from some of those who meet those the few exceptions, along with a photocopy of the ID. It would limit the locations of early voting sites. It would restrict mobile voting buses, like those that were used in Fulton County, requiring the polling places be in buildings. It would grant the legislature new powers to review emergency voting rules, such as ballot drop boxes, cleared by state officials during the pandemic. And those are just in that Senate bill. There's even more in the House bill, which was dropped and which actually could be acted on at some point in the day ahead. So, Greg, comment about first about the Dugan bill. I noticed that Kathy Cox, the former Secretary of State, said that one of the reasons back in 2005 the legislature agreed to no-excuse absentee balloting was before, when there were restrictions, how could any authority, any election authority, determine whether someone had a real excuse for having to cast an absentee ballot rather than an in-person ballot? But comment on all of that.
Yeah, it puts the government in a very difficult situation, state officials having to vet whether or not people had disabilities, whether or not people had legitimate excuses to vote by mail. And that's why Republicans and Democrats came together to support the regime we have now. And look, the big question is, how much of this is saber rattling by Republican officials who want to go out red meat to conservatives back home who some of them believed in President Trump's falsehoods about systemic voting fraud? And how much of this is them legitimately hoping to pass something onerous by the end of the session? Right now, you've kind of got a mix of this. I think that part of the strategy is go more restrictive at first and then start rolling it back so that the end package seems like it's somewhat of a compromise, even though many critics will still raise all sorts of concerns about it. But we've had this debate before where we talked about, let's say, with abortion. Oh, you know, they'll end up rolling those restrictions back when they didn't. And the governor ended up getting on board and Speaker Ralston ended up getting on board. All these people at first who were very lukewarm about passing the nation's strictest abortion limits ended up doing exactly that. So that's why we've been paying such close attention to these subcommittee hearings and committee here. Whatever bill passes will end up getting written, compromised upon 30 minutes or so before signee die in some conference committee. This won't be something that will have days and days and days of the final bill will not have days and days of debate, although all sorts of provisions of it will. But I think a lot of these Republican members have to show to their, for better or for worse, feel like they have to show back to the constituents at home that they're doing something to appease President Trump supporters.
Donna, you talk to a lot of legislators and lawmakers. Are they talking quietly? Maybe they're not saying it on the air, but are they saying quietly, yeah, we're going to compromise? Does Bluestein have a point here that what they're doing is going as far out as they can to please their right-wing base, but they'll come back a little bit toward a more hospitable position on some of these measures?
Yeah, I'm getting that impression from a few of them. It's interesting when I try to engage them on the conversation with this, the few that I have kind of pushed it off that, you know, we'll work out something. So I really do think there's this blizzard of elections reform bills that they're throwing out there. I agree that we're going to see them whittled down and then just a few will rise. And then that whole idea of saber rattling. I think that's definitely a part of all of this, just to show that there is some concern out there. On the other side, you know, there are the people who are very worried about this, and they are hoping that if anything gets through that they really disagree with, it is a really major challenge, that there will be a challenge in the courts. And so in the sense that with the heartbeat bill, that was a lot of the feeling there. Like, if nothing else, we still have the court system. They're really hoping that that'll happen. I will tell you that I'm hearing a whole lot of people very upset about the bill that focuses on getting rid of voting on Sunday in Souls to the Polls, which seems very much directed at the Black community in particular. And people who are just don't understand, as one person said, that, you know, you can now drink. Alcohol is permitted on Sunday, but you wouldn't be able to vote. And that just seems unfair. So there are people who are just waiting to see where all of this is going to land. And as we mentioned earlier, we're on the end of the session here. So we'll start seeing how some of this will stand up.
I'm glad you picked up on the Sunday voting bill, because I want to talk a bit more about that. Adam and then Renee, Democrats are saying that a lot of these measures are efforts at voter suppression. Republicans say, no, it's about voter integrity. It's about making sure that Georgians have faith in their elections. But an attempt to stop Sunday voting, which, as Donna points out, has been a souls to the polls day, where black churches in the state have organized to get their voters to the polls. Why create some sense that there is something pernicious about trying to maximize the number of people who turn out to vote, black or white?
Bill, I want to let Renee handle that before me, just because we don't have early voting on Sundays here, and so it doesn't apply to us. But after Renee's done, I want to circle back on something that Donna was talking about.
Renee?
Sure. Well, listen, again, I think that this is just another example of the small hurdles that just make it hard for people with very busy lives, with families living through what we've lived through in the last year, to not vote. And I think that we're at a crossroads right now, I think, in Georgia. And I think we've been at many crossroads in Georgia's history, in recent history, given the state is in such flux. What kind of Georgia are we building if we're making it difficult for voters to vote? We have gained national attention with voter turnout, with being a state wherein which we foster the kind of civic engagement that we're seeing with your average citizen. And why hinder that? Progress is here. It's really an interesting time.
Adam?
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Like I said, I wanted to circle back to what Don was talking about and talking to some lawmakers, and that's that a couple of weeks ago when the Senate rolled out their slew of initial bills on the voting reforms, I wrote a column basically saying, this is voter suppression. This is the definition of voter suppression. And I got I guess you would call it irate, because the person doesn't get irate, so he had an edge to his voice. So it was irate, one of our state senators, who basically said, hey, you're being divisive. You're being divisive here. You're trying to divide us. We're trying to react to the constituents. It was, if you read between the lines, he was basically saying, we're going to get to a compromise, but in the meantime, you and the media shouldn't do that. And my response to him was I didn't introduce legislation. How am I being the one that's being divisive? But that speaks to what Donna was saying. But I have an interesting question for Greg along this. Is all of this probably needs to pass this year, right, Greg? Because I know we can roll bills over into next year, but next year is an election year. So if they're going to do voting reforms, they probably want to go ahead and get them in place now.
Yeah, they want to get them in place this year, in time for the municipal elections at the end of November. Elections officials will rightly, if these are held over till next year. Also, you need to build in some sort of schedule for elections officials to actually impose and start enacting some of these changes. And really, remember, too, some of these proposals also seek to change the guidelines for runoffs and the timelines for how you find an outright primary winner and things like that. So that could change things as well for next year.
Greg, the Democrats in Georgia's U.S. House delegation sent a letter to Speaker of the House David Ralston and Senate Majority Leader Mike Dugan the other day. All of them signed off on it, all six of them. Among other things, they say, quote, this is blatant voter suppression. 2020 showed the largest voter turnout ever for Georgia, with minority groups making up a larger share of the state's electorate than ever before. It's critically important that our democracy which has been threatened by the events of January 6th, must ensure that people of Georgia have faith in our elections. Exceptional voter turnout should be celebrated, not discouraged. This is an entirely, Greg, entirely partisan issue. You do not have people coming together, even in small numbers, on both sides of the aisle supporting virtually any of these measures.
Yeah, this is the most divisive issue, maybe other than the transgender sports issue in the state capitol right now. It's hurtling towards some sort of conclusion. One of the Republicans who I often text back and forth with on background last night texted me, and he's in opposition to this, but texted me, this is going to be Exhibit 1A in Congress for why federal lawmakers should pass some sort of voting overhaul to preempt a lot of these changes in states like Georgia and others with the history of racial discrimination.
Yeah, and we know the U.S. House has HB 1, which is a major overhaul of voter rights and responsibilities that's now sitting in the House, probably not really going to pass. It's very likely more an expression of Democrats' belief about how elections should be run, but it does exist, and we'll watch as it moves forward in Washington. Let's do this. Let's get our first break of the show out of the way and come back with a lot more on Political Rewind.
Thanks for listening to Political Rewind. If you like this show, you'll also like Georgia Today. It's a daily podcast from GPB News, bringing you compelling stories and in-depth reporting that you won't hear anywhere else. Join me, Peter Biello, for this quick and convenient way to get the best of GPB News' extensive coverage of the topics that matter to you, delivered directly to your device every weekday afternoon.
I'm joined by a panel of outstanding Georgia journalists for today's Political Rewind. GPB TV lawmakers host Donna Lowry, AJC political reporter Greg Bluestein, president and CEO of Mundo Hispanico Digital, Renee Alegria, and the editorial page editor of Savannah Morning News, Adam Van Brimmer. Before we get off the legislature entirely and move to other political matters, Donna, these are two smaller measures, but I'm interested in what they tell us about Republicans in the legislature, in addition to just the bills themselves. One of them is that Representative Houston Gaines is pushing a bill that would block local municipalities from decreasing budgets to their police forces by more than 5%. There would be a penalty for cities that decided to do that. A response, of course, Donna, to what many people think is the Black Lives Matter initiated effort to rethink policing, in some cases defund policing in this country. Yes?
Absolutely. And I will announce now that he will be on the show tonight. So you can tune in because we're definitely going to be talking with him a little bit about it. So got that plug in. Yeah, this is definitely a response to the whole defund the police movement and over policing. But, you know, he's from the Athens-Clark County area, and there was an incident, I think, in Greene County, I believe. I don't know, Greg, you may know this better than I do, where there was a county commission that actually pulled away, actually let their police department go, basically, stopped funding their police department. The sheriff's department had to take over. So there have been, you know, that's at least one instance in Georgia where we've seen somebody some municipality tried to make some difference in all of this in terms of having control over the police department. Gaines, I think, is only, you know, 5% isn't much, but it is showing that there is an interest in possibly making some changes in this area. It also, the other side of it, though, is also that people are feeling that this is too much, that, it, you know, we, especially Republicans, and Gaines is a Republican, but focuses so much on local control, and this would take away some local control. And of course, you had the municipalities pushing back on this.
Go ahead.
Sure. Yeah. No. Listen, I do think that there the mistrust that communities have with certain aspects of police departments across the state, certainly across the country right now, is at an all-time high. I mean, we all saw what happened, say, at the Capitol, you know, where you actually saw some police folks just, you know, let folks in, presumably, right, allegedly. And I think that mood, that environment is certainly spilling into our local political discussions, funding, et cetera, and the perception of what is right, what is real, what is not. Obviously, from the Hispanic perspective, we really look to our police force to take care of us, right? And that has just not been the case traditionally. So there is that mistrust. And I do think that when we read about what is happening, you know, 5%, whatnot, we look at it as just a pure political ploy. And what does that do really to the average Georgian? We don't think much.
Greg?
Yeah, look, this is tapping into the overall Republican messaging. We heard a lot of through 2020 of defunding the police, even though it was not really an issue in states like Georgia, where it might have been an issue in Oregon and in some, you know, more progressive-led states. It just wasn't this major issue. But I was meeting up with a staffer for former Senator Perdue yesterday, who was just marveling about how effective that argument it was against John Ossoff for a while, because there was one interview where Ossoff seemed to somewhat defend defunding police, and he quickly walked back his comments in interviews with me and other outlets. But they relentlessly pummeled him over that one phrase he gave on one interview in June of 2020 to great effect, you know, because it helps galvanize conservative supporters who see this over and over again on Fox News and other conservative media outlets, even though there is no substantial effort to defund the police. You know, what Donna was talking about, was there are some smaller police departments that in smaller towns that we swallowed up by sheriff's departments because, you know, the local taxing issues and local jurisdictional issues. But there's been no movement, especially in rural Georgia, to eliminate law enforcement officers and things like that.
Adam, that bill and another one, the House has now approved a bill that would limit how cities can place mandates on the kind of energy that would go into construction, into buildings. So you couldn't create an all-green building and get LEED certification. It would insist that that strict zoning measures could not be enforced. And that's an interesting bill in and of itself, but combining that with the defunding of the police measure, I guess it makes it clearer than ever to us that Republicans, as much as that this notion that Republicans believe in local control, not state or federal control, just is no longer operative, and they are as concerned about state authority as Democrats have always been.
They embrace it at their convenience. Right. I mean, that's really what this is. It's total hypocrisy. We go back. Greg might correct me. I think it was 2 years ago where they passed the monuments law and basically took the power away from local municipalities or denied them the ability to claw back the power to move monuments. They said it wasn't about Confederate monuments. That was obviously clearly about Confederate monuments. And that's the linchpin with the state legislature right now is they feel like they can control whatever they feel like they want to control. And there's a certain amount of give and take that should be there between local governments and state government. But I think the line is blurrier now than it has ever been. And I don't think the Republicans can, any Republican that talks about limited government anymore, you know, it's hard not to roll your eyes.
Okay, well, we'll be interested, Donna, in seeing what Houston Gaines says about why this measure for penalizing cities that defund their police departments by more than reduce funding by more than 5%, what his rationale is. And it will be on lawmakers tonight at 7 o'clock on Georgia Public Broadcasting statewide TV network. All right, Bluestein, we've held off long enough. David Perdue is not going to run for Raphael Warnock's seat in the United States Senate next year. But Kelly Loeffler has now launched an effort that really looks as if she may be headed in the direction of a rematch with Warnock. Talk to us about all of this.
Yeah, so Perdue's decision, the big impact of it is that he had frozen the field, even by flirting with running, and that no other prominent Republicans could get in the race while he was still deliberating, much like what happened 2 years ago with Stacey Abrams, or last year, with Stacey Abrams ruminating about a U.S. Senate run. If you remember, Teresa Tomlinson ended up finally getting frustrated and saying, I will run if she doesn't. You know, in this case, David Perdue made his decision fairly, you know, a lot quicker than a lot of people thought, just after 8 days, saying he's not running, freeing wide open that door for other people to run. Kelly Loeffler is right in there. She has not made up her mind yet. She told me on Monday that she's considering it. The biggest question she faces is what makes next year's run any different than last year's run, when she was pulled increasingly to the right by Doug Collins. She had to face questions over her loyalty to President Trump. And she, in her words and in Governor Kemp's words, she was never able to run the campaign she wanted to run. Well, if she runs again in next year, she might face the same concerns. President Trump still looms over this race, and she'll be probably challenged by someone like Doug Collins or someone else who would pull her to the right. Her answer to this is this group called Greater Georgia. She feels like whether she runs or not, it will change the dynamic for Republican politics in Georgia, because it does what Stacey Abrams' group has done so effectively since 2018, which is registering, mobilizing hundreds of thousands of in their conservative-leaning voters, advocating for policies, building a grassroots network, and pushing for some of these voting measures that Democrats see as so restrictive in the Georgia Capitol. So she feels like that could be the game changer that A, raises her profile, but B, also helps Republicans across the state.
All right, so this sets up what could be fascinating race in the Republican primary for next year, leading up to the reelection campaign that Raphael Warnock will run. Let's do this. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way, and then talk a little bit more about the dynamics of what we expect could develop in the year ahead for that U.S. Senate seat. Before we continue with today's conversation, a quick program note. As I mentioned earlier in the show, tomorrow we're going to talk about the state's schools and the controversy over whether they should be open, whether they shouldn't be. Adam Van Brimmer's kids went back to school in Savannah today, but there are still so many questions about how safe or unsafe it is for our kids to be in school. What are the detrimental effects of their doing distance learning? And we're going to talk about that on the show. We'll be led in our conversation by Greg's colleague at the AJC, Maureen Downey, who's a longtime education writer for the paper. Greg, your kids have gone through both, right? Adam, we talk about Adam Van Brimmer, but your kids have been doing, I think, virtual and in person. Is that right?
I wish. My kid in DeKalb County Schools is still virtual. She came down to bother me. Wednesdays, they actually have days off, so I don't know why. So she's just running around upstairs as we speak. And then we pulled our first grader out. I never thought I'd ever have this end of, I'm a public school guy. My wife is a public school gal. Both of our parents are public school teachers, both of our mothers. But my first grader couldn't do it anymore. So she now goes to a private school down the road.
Yeah. Yeah. I think DeKalb is going to go to in-person schooling starting maybe as soon as next week. Donna Lowry, you've been an educator. Your whole career was built around your expertise in education.
Absolutely.
I think DeKalb's announced they're going to start in-person classes again, right?
Yeah, they are. And they've been the real holdout, like where you've had some counties start and stop and that kind of thing, or do the hybrid of a little. DeKalb has been, nobody's been going back. And so I think they're feeling that it's about time to do that. And that'll be really strange. Imagine these kids have not been in school for almost a year now, and they're going to be returning to the classroom. So it'll be interesting to see how that will work out. And then there's, you know, everybody is worried about this learning loss that these students have have right at this point. So it'll be we'll have to wait and see how they're going to be able to deal with that, whether we're going to see maybe the kids going to school all summer.
All right. Well, we will be talking about that tomorrow on Political Rewind, and hope you can all join in. I mean, one other quick note. We did a show yesterday on the one-year anniversary of the sad death of Ahmaud Arbery, and talked a lot about what's happening with racial justice in the state and in the country since then. If you follow either me or Political Rewind on Twitter, which, by the way, you can do, you can join us on Twitter by going to @politicsgpb, or you can follow me at NIGUTB, NIGUTB. I posted this morning a tweet about a show that Netflix has put up right now. Our good friend Kenny Leon is one of the directors of a series called Amend, and it tells the history of the 14th Amendment, which many people are not really aware of, and what a powerful force it's been for good, but also troubles that it's encountered in trying to establish racial justice in this country. And I really suggest, if you're interested in shows like we did yesterday, check out Amend on Netflix. All right, Renee Alegria, back to the topic at hand. I think the people who are anticipating the potential for a rematch between Kelly Loeffler and Doug Collins next year, I mean, mostly, I think Republicans are afraid of it. We know how the impact it had last year in terms of hurting Kelly Loeffler when she eventually won. But for political junkies, come on, how much better does it get than that potential?
It's like WrestleMania 1, right? Talk about a battle royal. That everybody can't wait to see what happens, what Collins will say, how he will position what the right, you know, outflanks Loeffler, et cetera. I mean, it's going to be a dance to see what happens. But getting back to Purdue, you know, I just couldn't help but think, as we were all talking about, how just tired he looked there toward the end. You know, the entire process was so exhausting, right? I mean, all of us were tired there, Jan Forrest, you know? I mean, we all couldn't wait for it to be over in some respects. And here you have an executive who, you know, rather white glove, really wasn't out there like, you know, so like a Warnock, say, who's just like man of the people, like flourishes in that type of spotlight. And it, you know, it's no surprise that Bluestein called it the way he did. He's right on. And to me, it's just, you know, watching someone like Purdue navigate the minefield of what contemporary Georgia politics is becoming is really interesting. You know, I mean, the increased diversity of the state means it's a different type of state. You run a different type of campaign that a lot of, say, that older guard just doesn't really understand, right? You do have players like the rise of the Hispanic voter, the rise of the Asian voter, you know, the millennial, and frankly, the influence that Gen Z has with pushing their parents to vote here or there, right, is something that I don't think a lot of politicians in the traditional sense are really understanding how to do correctly. So it's no surprise. It is going to be interesting what type of campaign Loeffler starts to build, but it's definitely not your mama's Georgia anymore.
Yeah, Adam, I think in all fairness to Purdue, we should point out he did have COVID-19, so he probably was looking a lot more tired than he might normally be. But I think nevertheless, Renee makes a good point. Running for election, Adam, you know, there used to be a real genuine public service component to being an elected official in Congress. And certainly there are those who still run because they do believe in the issues they'd like to try to see passed by Congress. But the partisan gridlock in Washington is such that there are any number of people who are choosing not to run at all, or certainly not to run again, as perhaps David Perdue has decided, not just in this case, but maybe to go back to a private career where he can be much more successful in the corporate sector.
Yeah, I think you might be giving David Perdue a little bit too much credit there. I don't see him as necessarily a major man of the people, as Renee said. No, I don't want to psychoanalyze and figure out why he ran or why he didn't run or why he ran the way he did in December. But it certainly, as you look ahead to 2022 and who is going to run, and you know, the whole idea of Loeffler and Collins just basically gives me a splitting headache, even at the mention of it, because somebody was talking about Loeffler's campaign earlier. As bad as Perdue's campaign was this last time, Loeffler's was worse. Loeffler's was god-awful. Now, can she actually decide to stand on her own 2 feet in 2022 and actually send a message let's just leave it at that. We'll wait and see. But if we're looking at Loeffler and Collins from 2020 again, I know it's a gubernatorial year. I know the Republicans are going to be out in force to vote for governor, and that should help the senator. But I find it very, very challenging to think that Loeffler and Collins, depending especially how they ran last year, would be able to mount any more of a fight against Warnock than they did a year ago.
Greg, am I jumping the gun to think that there might be a rematch between the two of them?
No, I think it's fair to say, because both of them have told the AJC that they're thinking about running, seriously thinking about running, and people around them back that up. So I don't put them in the same category as I put Senator Perdue in. I still think it's unlikely, but the fascinating part that both of them will run, I think there's a good chance one of them might run. But the fascinating thing about this is David Perdue is the only one who could clear the field, maybe short of his cousin Sonny mm-hmm. Perdue deciding to run. So even if Kelly Loeffler and Doug Collins both get into this race, I don't think it will scare off other Republicans for doing so as well. I published a lengthy list of potential contenders, and I've reached out to every single one of them in some form or fashion before I included them on the list. But there are some other names out there that could be really intriguing. Jeff Duncan is one of them who has not ruled it out. He's been talking about a GOP 2.0. He's kind of trying to find the lane of mainstream conservative who's not a pro-Trumper, who supported Trump but is not, you know, hewing to Trumpism. Chris Carr is out there. Former Chief Justice Harold Melton has been bandied about a lot. He is not quite there yet, but he hasn't ruled it out yet either. And then there's some other names like Herschel Walker, like Kelvin King, who are being promoted out there. I know the folks are laughing, but there are serious talks among Republican circles that Herschel Walker could be at least thinking about this run. We have not been able to reach him directly yet. I've had our sports reporters on it because I don't have his cell. But like, you know, don't be surprised. I know conservative media has already started to rev up talk about Herschel Walker running. And you know, look, this is all going to be about who ends up coming in with Trump's blessing, or if Trump stays on the sidelines, like we know he probably won't on the governor's race, which is a whole different story. But he's already promised to endorse a challenger to Governor Kemp. What he does in the Senate race will be a huge factor in the Republican primary.
Meanwhile, Donna Raphael Warnock has responded to this by essentially saying, bring it on. I'm ready for whoever comes after me.
Yeah, I think he feels real confident about things. He is working in Washington, and boy, sending out press releases like crazy from his campaign about all the things that he's doing. I think there's the feeling that there was a lot of momentum with his campaign that will continue. And if he can continue to keep that energy alive, that he has a pretty good chance with all of this. People are still talking about how well he did in terms of positioning himself with his ads and the way he was able to make things move on to actually be voted in. So I think he's ready for this and is feeling energized, and so are the people who have supported him. So I think that's a big part of it.
Meanwhile, Renee, to bring this all back full circle to where we started, the election bills in the state legislature, what Georgia legislators pass and the governor signs this year in terms of changing voting laws could have an enormous impact on what happens, not only in that Senate race, but as long as we're talking about it, how things turn out for the voters that Raphael Warnock is able to bring to the polls.
Agreed. I always talk about the little hurdles that create, you know, the giant barrier of individuals from not voting to voting. What is very clear in our world in the state is that the policies that affect the Hispanic community affect the future of Georgia, the Hispanic community being integral to the future of Georgia.
Renee Alegria, you get the last word on today's Political Rewind. Thank you so much for joining us. Don Lowry, see you tonight at 7 for Lawmakers on GPB TV. Adam Van Brimmer, thank you for being here. We look forward to reading you in the Savannah Morning News or online at Savannah Now. And Greg Bluestein, thank you for being with us. We look forward to seeing you again on our show next week. In the meantime, we're out of time. As I said, tomorrow we talk about education in Georgia, how it's been affected by the coronavirus. I am Bill Nygut. I'll see you tomorrow. But in the meantime, take care, stay healthy, wear a mask. Bye-bye, everybody.